of Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host of the most, Nikki Kourula. We're going to jump right into this special edition of Wake Up, Hollywood. We're doing something cool because I'm interviewing somebody that actually has interviewed me in the past, Mr. Stephen Peoples. How are you, Stephen?
I'm doing great, Nikki. It's great to be with you again. How are you?
Good to see you. Good to see you. And you know what? I thought I saw you, and I knew I saw you at the Neil Young concert. I'm like, I think that's Stephen Peoples. I'm like, I don't want to holler out in case it's not, but I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's Stephen Peoples. So when you posted about the Neil Young show, I was like, I knew it was you. I knew it. So it's so awesome to, I'm sorry we didn't see each other at that concert, but.
That's all right. That was a wonderful shared experience.
Yeah. What? And you went twice, right?
I did. I was fortunate enough to go to the second show at the Ford Theater, which was pretty amazing. 1,200 seat venue,
right
in the Cahuenga Pass, and the backdrop for the stage is the hillside. It's just beautiful, and they have it manicured perfectly, and it's just it's better than any painted backdrop you could have. And
yeah, then, I wanted to go and get tickets there, but they only had singles left. So I was like,
I got lucky. A good friend of mine named Jim Piccirillo, who's a TV event producer, and his wife took Nadine and me, my wife, as their guests. And
so we
lucked out. That was a last minute thing. But weeks before, we'd bought tickets to the Greek, and the prices were so outrageous. We bought tickets. The cheapest tickets in the house were at the very, very last
benches,
row.
The benches.
The
right?
Benches. Row D of the benches, which is the last row of the benches, but we were in the house. It was great. You know, it was funny though. We had a retaining wall behind us, and then behind us was hillside. So if we'd been any farther back, we would have been tree people.
You were hanging with the coyotes, but you know I've seen many a show like that, and I just love being at the Greek, and you saw him also at an even smaller venue. And we both know Chris Pierce has actually been a guest on Wake Up Hollywood before too. And it was so awesome to see him. He's doing the whole leg. He's doing the entire leg of the tour. And it's just amazing.
Well, after seeing him open at the Ford and being stunned by his performance and his songs, I wasn't familiar with him before that, but it really impressed the hell out of me. And so we made a concerted effort, if you will, to get to the Greek on time to see him in a larger setting. And I thought it was very impressive, since you brought it up, I thought it was very impressive that he commanded the Greek audience within a couple of songs.
Oh, yeah.
He's the opening act, and people are still filing in and everything, but people shut up and listen to him.
Yeah, the other thing, too,
impressive.
I knew that he was going to captivate because I've just known him forever, and we played shows together, and he's just an awesome soul. And the crazy thing was, opening for Neil Young, that's a pretty big, you know, it's a big opportunity, but it's also like you're trying to fill some big shoes too, because it's just solo. It's just Neil, and it's just Neil's songs, and it's just Chris and Chris's songs. And you really have to be able to fill that space with a lot of vibe, and he's perfect for that. So I'm so happy he actually got that opportunity. And, you know, it's like he just turned 50 like a couple days ago. And for him to get that opportunity turning 50, it's so well-deserved and so awesome. It's like, the music industry has glimmers of hope when you see stuff like that, you know?
Well, you know, there are no overnight successes, and he's a perfect example.
That's right.
You know, he's paid his dues. He's getting great exposure right now on Neil's tour, and I hope it leads to something bigger and better for him.
As it should. But let's talk about you, Stephen. The last time I saw you in person was at Santa Clarita TV. We were doing your show, House Blend. You did an amazing interview on me and my band, and just I played a couple songs, and it was such a cool experience. And you reached out to me recently, and you're like, I want to interview you about your album that's coming out, and I want to do it on your show. And I'm like, that's a great idea, but I want to interview you first, because that's how this should work. We're going to do an interview swap. So tonight, I'm
going to
interview
you
about your life and your storied career, because you've had an amazing amount of experiences and just really cool things that are going on. Let's start way back from the beginning. Did you grow up in Miami, I saw, or LA? Did you kind of, which one did you grow up first? Where were you born?
Well, I'll telescope this real quickly, but both my folks are from the Midwest. They met at the University of Illinois. My dad was editor at the Daily Illini. My mom showed up as a student reporter and reported for work, and he happened to be the person that she reported to, and one thing led to the other, and you know, they got married within a couple of years, and I came along a few years later in 51. They actually had me when they were on the way home from Colorado to Illinois. They were on a road trip, and so they had to stop to have me. And so I was born in Kansas City, Missouri.
Wow.
And as soon as mom was ready to roll, they'd, you know, completed the journey back to Chicago. And I've never been back to this day. I've never been back to Kansas City, Missouri. I've been to St. Louis, but you know, it's one of those things on the bucket list, but it's right, kind of down on the priority list.
Well, it's big in the barbecue world. You got to go there just for the barbecue.
For the barbecue. And yeah, I would check that out. See how it compares to Stubbs in Texas.
That's right. That's right. Austin. That's a classic one as well. And did you grow up in the Midwest, or did you grow up in Miami?
So no, then the folks moved to South Florida when I was about seven. Okay. My dad had during World War II, he was in the Navy. He was in pretty much the duration of the entire war. He enlisted a few weeks after Hitler invaded Poland in September of 39. And he left in 46. He was on the fleet that was en route to invade Japan when the bomb was dropped. So he was part of the fleet that was there in the aftermath of that. And he never went on shore and didn't see any of the, but, you know, he heard a lot about it, and we all read about it. Anyway, long story short, he had spent some time in South Florida and decided that was a far better environment to raise his family than the snowy Midwest. And I concurred.
Yes, absolutely.
I can recall just a real quick story. I can recall one day, probably was about 5 years old, and I was walking to my kindergarten class in a blizzard, and it was 37 degrees below zero, and I got blown off my feet into a snowdrift. I got to school and found out that it was closed for the day, so I had to walk up. Fortunately, it was three or four blocks. It wasn't, you know, wasn't a long distance, but I think it was within one or two winters after that that Pop decided we're done with this and we're moving to South Florida. So he moved to South Florida and reconnected with some of his journalist pals from college and landed a job as a writer editor at the Miami News.
Wow.
So then moved the family down there, and then my mom eventually got a job at the Miami News as a proofreader. So there was a period of time in early 60s, 62, 63, in that neighborhood. I'm 10, 11, 12 years old in there, where they're both working at the Miami News. And as a, for instance, I'm too old to hire a babysitter. So they'd take me to work with them on Saturday afternoons when they're working on the Sunday newspaper, right? Wow. So, and all of the honchos were not there. So it was kind of like I had the free run of the newspaper. So so mom taught me how to proofread. Dad taught me how to edit. I hung out with the composing room guys downstairs. They have, with the hot lead linotype machines,
wow,
the huge printing presses that are as large as a truck. And, you know, all of the old school newspaper, the smell of the place, right? So
it smells like paper and ink, right?
Yeah. So all of that, it's all in the DNA, you know. It's just, that's right. kind of the way it worked.
And then were they big on music, like in the house?
Well, let me wrap up the story. I got to get us from Florida to California, and then we can take it from there. But I was about 16, between junior year of high school and senior year of high school. And Pop decided that he wanted to go back to school. He wanted to get his master's and PhD because he wanted to teach anthropology. And so he went back to college, University of Miami. He got a master's in history and then a master's in anthropology. And then in order to continue his studies, he would have to go to either the University of Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh,
wow,
or the University of California at Los Angeles. So we had a family meeting in the spring of 68. I'm in 11th grade, getting ready to graduate 11th grade. And a Pop says, okay, I'm going to school at one of these two schools. Which one should I pick? And my sister Ruthie, who's 3.5 years younger, we just looked at each other and we said, Dad, UCLA, of course. We've got to go to LA.
Yeah.
I mean, by that time we were totally involved in music. I was involved in surfing. So I was reading all the surf magazines and all the surf spots on the West Coast were there, and all the music things that were happening. Think about 67 and 68, what was going on.
That was all that stuff, right?
In LA, it was just blowing up.
Right.
The transition between top 40 radio and FM radio was happening right there. You know, KHJ, Wolfman Jack, and KMET and KPPC. It was a great time to land here anyway, and I was 16 years old. But so that's how I got to L.A., and it took a few years for me to do it, but I eventually landed a gig in the business, and, you know, that's another story. But
So did you have music, like, playing all the time at home? Were your parents kind of, like, way big
always
on, and your family was, like, always listening to music? Because it has to start somewhere, and I'm sure it's your friends, you know?
Yeah, always. My dad was a big band jazz fanatic, so that was happening a lot in the house. I first heard Les Paul and Mary Ford as a toddler.
That's crazy.
You know, I know that my mom was a huge Johnny Mathis fan.
Yeah.
She played Johnny Mathis's greatest hits. She would just turn that sucker over and just all day long. You know, I could still remember Chances Are and The 12th of Never. And, you know, these just I could sing them like any Beatles song.
He still tours. I'm dying to see
him. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, bless his pointed little head, you know, carry on. That's great. It's a wonderful thing. But yeah, music was always an important factor. Plus my mom played piano. She started when she was a teenager playing piano, and played piano through high school. We had a piano in the house all as we were growing up. And my favorite piece, I never talk about this stuff with anybody.
I love it.
My favorite piece that my mom played was Chopin's Etude in E Major.
That's amazing.
La da 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 Of course, I'm mangling it, but I mean, you get the idea.
Yeah,
I think people will get know what the melody is. But
and Chopin is not easy to play on piano, too.
And she would play, and you know, my sister and I would just kind of sit there underneath the piano at her feet and watch her feet on the pedals and watch the hammers go on the it was a wonderful thing. And then here's another thing. My dad, there was a period when my dad, this is crazy. There was actually when we moved to Miami, he had to wait 2 or 3 months for an opening to come up, to go back to the newspaper. It's a whole long story, but during that 3 or 4 month period, he sold cars at a local Ford dealership.
Wow.
And this Ford dealership had a jukebox in the lobby. And it was one of those that was on wheels. So I could like roll it away from the wall and get behind the jukebox. And that was where I was introduced to a bass speaker about this big. And because I was listening to a transistor radio, a 6-transistor radio with a 2-inch speaker, there were notes that I was hearing on in this jukebox space that I never heard on my transistor radio. While we're on radio, I'm looking at this LA Talk Radio thing. Radio was such a huge part of growing up. My dad was actually a member of the Jack and Jill Players.
Wow.
In Chicago. He was a child radio actor. He stopped basically when his voice changed. One of my uncles, one of his brothers, went on to be a famous radio and television comic actor in Chicago.
That was like a major form of entertainment. You know what I mean?
It was.
People would listen to like shows and plays on the radio.
No, actually, yeah, it was, but he took it, Corny took it to personal appearances. So he dressed up in a clown outfit. And so awesome. there was a segment of my dad's family that was showbiz savvy. And so that was very cool. But radio was, my dad had a Motorola tabletop wooden radio. And I inherited it at some point, and I was 6 or 7. This is shortly after we moved to Miami, and I was tuning in the Chicago White Sox games because the White Sox were doing their spring training there, so the local radio station would carry the White Sox games. So I became a White Sox fan, but I'm tuning into Chicago radio. I picked up WLS. I picked up WABC. I picked up WBZ in Boston, which is even farther north. And then there was, I think it was WBZ. And then WLS was in, or WSB rather, in Atlanta. I picked that up. And I could pick up these weird Caribbean radio stations. I couldn't figure out what the hell it was. But the music was off the hook. And this was at night, of course. And the thing was, Florida is flat. There is nothing but ocean and a straight line between South Florida and the northeast coast of the United States. So the signal would just skip from New York across the water. And I'm listening to Top 40 WQAM in Miami, 64, 65, 66. And I'll never forget this. This is my introduction to bullshit and radio. I hear a WQAM world premiere, Dave Clark 5. Try Too Hard. We're the only ones in the universe that have this song. You know, and they play it, and they play it 5 or 6 times, and they're just making the big hoopla on it. And then I turn the dial, you know. That was WFUN at 790. In Miami, and I turned the dial to 770, just the next station over, and it's WABC in New York, and it's Cousin Brucey going, world premiere. We're the only ones in the universe. It got this Dave Clark vibe. Try to.
That's wild.
I love this.
You're seeing like the cycle of how pop music is kind of starting, you know?
Oh, just incredible. And as I said before, you know, when we did finally move to California, and I was completely wired into top 40 during the heyday and had a transistor radio surgically implanted. And it was, you go to the beach and, you know, 500 kids would be tuned to the same radio station. You could hear it. We'd be out surfing and we could hear the music on the, from the, all of the radios on the beach. It was just, it was a great time and place to grow up. And then California, when I landed here, it was right in the middle of 68. It was, as I said, a very transitional period in radio from commercial to non-commercial and drugs and no drugs.
Yeah, you're right, the psychedelic period of rock and roll, right?
Yeah. And you know, God, when my dad and I were rolling into town the first day that we rolled in June of 68, we came in from Southern Route on Interstate 10. So we rolled in like from Tucson and Yuma towards San Diego, and that's where I first heard Wolfman Jack.
Wolfman Jack.
You know, he had that voice.
All right, we're going to play this greatest hits for you right now, baby.
But he was like one of the biggest tastemakers. He was like one of the first to also play the Beatles and kind of start that as well. Now, you kind of like came to the West Coast after the Beatles came, but did that your love of music once they kind of arrived, that British
band? Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd already started playing drums. I was a jazz. I kind of got into jazz through kind of indirectly through my dad. The stuff that he didn't like, I liked.
Right.
So I'm listening to, you know, to Dave Brubeck, which is pretty white at the time, but you know, I was 7 or 8 years old. And actually, my dad did me a great service. This is a story I don't think I've told publicly, but shortly after we moved to Florida and he started working at the newspaper again, he had connections, so he got tickets to go see the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
Oh, wow.
At the University of Miami. They had a big basketball court and they would have concerts in there. So Pop took Mom and my sister and me, the four of us, to this concert, afternoon concert. I guess it was a Sunday, a matinee concert. And there's the quartet down at center court, right? Just, it was unbelievable. And because it was a basketball arena, the acoustics were horrible for music. But I'll never forget it. They were playing Take Five and Joe Morello started doing his drum solo. And if you're familiar with the song and his solo, there's a point where he starts just stomping on the kick drum for accents. And when he did that, it was like somebody set off a bomb in the place. It was so loud. And I remember I turned to my dad. I said, I want to do that.
That's like sensory overload. That's what's cool about that.
I want to do that, you know. And 59, well, a couple of years later, I conned them into, they bought me a snare drum and I did okay with that. And then they got me a practice pad and then, you know, I conned them into,
like, give me a kit.
Paying for drum lessons. And then one thing led to another. And I finally got a drum set by the time I was 14 or 15 and was playing to records in my bedroom with the stereo turned up and big speakers on either side of me playing along to every 45 that you could imagine. I just did this for fun. I wasn't doing this professionally, but you know, radio, music, playing it myself, coming to California, surfing. Oh my God, I got a surfboard. I got a car. I can go. I hit every damn surf spot that I'd read about from Santa Barbara to the Mexican border.
Wow.
And then after I turned 21, I went down to Ensenada, but not before. I didn't want to get, you know,
You didn't want to get kidnapped.
Too sketchy. But anyway, so summer of 68 was a great time to land here, but it took me a few years of going to school and living here and figuring it out to actually get from civilian to industry person.
Right.
That happened.
Were you seeing a lot of live music? Like Sunset Strip was
all the time. Right. Yeah.
Who are some people you saw live on the Sunset Strip?
On the Strip, my God. Actually, it was more concerts because on the Strip, it was hard. I didn't have a car, yet. But I was able to borrow the folks' car. I went to more concerts with other people.
Right.
But I'll mention a couple. October 68, I went with four other guys in a car, and it was like a Cheech and Chong scene with the smoke coming out of the windows the whole fucking way down to the Forum to see Cream's farewell show.
Wow.
That was pretty cool.
Dude.
That was very cool. And then the following spring, I did have a car, and this would be spring of 69 now. And there's a venue called the Rose Palace in Pasadena that was putting on rock shows. And Joe Cocker played there. So I went to see him.
Wow.
And this was Chris Stanton was in the band. It was the Grease band, basically.
Right.
And it was just freaking stunning. This is before Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And this is before he was really, really huge. And then my girlfriend Debbie, and I her last name started with a D, but I'm not gonna, I haven't seen her in 35, 40 years, but who knows if she's still around. But she wanted to go see Led Zeppelin.
Oh my God.
Which was the week after. This would be May of 69. And I really wanted to go because I wanted to see Jimmy Page, and John Bonham. But she wanted to go for Robert Plant. Okay. It was unbelievable. I mean, we were like, for me,
is that where the Forum?
No. This is the Rose Palace.
Oh man.
This was a very small venue. There were probably couldn't have been more than, 1,500 or 2,000 people there. And we were all standing up. It was, I was like from me to you to the stage. I could look up there and there's, there's Jimmy Page with his bow sawing on his Les Paul, and I'm just going out of my mind. And my girlfriend over here is just, she's frothing at Robert Plant. Let me just say that the drive home was, it was good that I was convenient.
That's awesome.
Oh boy. Now we lived in the West Valley at that time. So I drove all the way from Pasadena to the West Valley it was just a really interesting drive home. Let's just put it that way.
Right.
Those are two neat things. Also, what
was the most interesting thing about Cream, seeing them? Cause like not many people have seen Cream as a trio live. Do you remember, was it the guitar tone? Was it like the energy? Like, I'm obsessed with blues trios right now, so this is a question for me.
Well, I it was really the sound and the tone of Clapton's Les Paul, basically. Wow. And now we were, because we were poor high school kids, we had seats in the colonnade at the Forum, so we were literally all the way at the back in the middle. And in those days, cigarette smoking was allowed. And dope smoking was not allowed, but people did it anyway. So there was this incredibly thick, toxic cloud that was hanging right up at the colonnade on top of. So we're breathing this shit and listening to this just ear-busting music.
Wow.
You got to understand that this is very, very early in on stage PA systems and sound quality for touring musicians. The Grateful Dead and Owsley, those guys really kind of blueprinted it. But there were a couple of outfits in LA that were developing this, but it was still really new. Even in 68 and into by 69 and 70, it was. But like the Shrine concerts that were put on by Pinnacle Concerts in late 68 and early 69, those were all with like a brand new sound system that had been built for that venue. John Van Hammersfeld was telling me about this. He was one of the partners in Pinnacle Concerts. And so when I saw Cream at the Forum in October of 68, the sound quality I would think would have been, you know, 500 times better, or it was 500 times worse than it would be now.
Like, you just didn't hear vocals, or was it just like it was all?
We could hear everything. It wasn't as crystal clear as we would like it.
Right.
There was a certain, you know, muddy element to it. But I do remember Clapton's guitar cutting through a lot of it.
Man, I love Eric Clapton. He's like one of my favorites. And, you know, I covered one of his songs on this new record I'm doing. And I'm obsessed with Clapton. And my next question is,
let me throw this in real fast. I had a garage band also that I played with in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and well into the 2000s. And the Cream arrangement of Crossroads was one of our warm-up songs. I have probably 30 versions of us playing that on tape over the years.
And that's what my record's called. My record's called Crossroads.
Okay, here's a quick story. Really? Okay, here's a quick story. I had occasion to meet and do some stuff, PR stuff with Hal Blaine back in the 90s. He was like a legendary drummer, part of the LA session, wrecking crew rather, played on pretty much LA every session you could imagine, all of the early Beach Boys records. So he was a hero of mine. So when I was at Rhino in the mid 90s, the label put together a 4-CD box set. And it had like 96 surf songs on it from the 60s. And as it turned out, I just went through I said, Hal Blaine, Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, Gary Usher, you know, all of these guys, right? Hal Blaine was the drummer. It was just insane. So I made contact with him through the Musicians Union. It was great. I called, you know, Local 47. I said, I need to get a hold of Hal Blaine. And they said, here's his number. So I called him. And I said, hey, I'm at Rhino. We got this project coming out. You did, there are like 12 tracks on it. Would you be interested in doing some interviews and do some press? Would you, if somebody wanted to talk to you about some of this stuff, would you be interested? And he said, sure. So he was one of my guys from the Ventures were in there, and Dean Torrance and Corky Carroll. I had this whole group of guys. All of these guys, again, going back to Florida, that I idolized from 3,000 miles away. I'm now in the 90s. I'm like hanging out with them. That's crazy. It was insane. I did an internet chat with the Ventures when I was at Rhino in the late 90s, and when it was like nobody knew how to do this. It was just crazy. Let me tie up the story. So Crossroads, I had a copy of it on tape. I went over to see Hal at his place. He lived actually just a few miles from me. It's crazy. And I took this two tapes over. I took one tape over of the Mr. Tambourine Man session.
Yeah, I know that.
From Columbia that Terry Melcher had produced and he played on, and McGuinn was the guitar player and everybody else was Wrecking Crew guys. And so it's like a 20-minute session, and at the end of the tape is the keeper. But it's just it's brilliant, a brilliant how a record is made kind of thing in 20 minutes. And so he didn't have a copy of it. I said, I would be honored to present this copy to you. And he says, great, thank you very much. So I said, would you mind listening to this? Would you indulge me? And I played him my version of Crossroads. He says, who's that playing drums? I said, that's me. He says, that's pretty good. I said, okay, I can die and go to heaven.
You're like, that's it. That's you know, why you're not telling me that.
That's it. You know, I don't have to be in a band or whatever. But no, but I saw a lot of great music back in the early days. Went in.
Did you ever see Hendrix?
I saw Hendrix 3 times.
Oh my God! Tell me where and what shows.
Okay. The first time, and I'm looking at the poster. Hold on a second.
Oh my God!
I can't take it off the wall. But May 1968. I still lived in Miami. I'm a high school junior, and it was actually Michael Lang, right, and a couple Woodstock. Of partners.
Yeah, Woodstock.
The guy who did Woodstock. Well, his training ground was the Miami Pop Festival, and there were two of them in 1968. The first of them was in May at the Gulfstream racetrack, which was a horse racing track that was a little bit north of Miami but south of Fort Lauderdale. So it's kind of in between Miami and Fort Lauderdale, kind of on the beach. And it was a festival, and people sat on the ground, and then in the grandstands behind the ground, and then on the fairway in the middle, there were flatbed semi trucks set up, three of them back to back, and so they would set up a band, and one band would be playing, and they'd set up the next band, and it was like there was no waiting between performances. And so I saw Hendrix there. I saw Crazy World of Arthur Brown there. Mothers of Invention.
Wow. What do you remember from Hendrix?
I thought, to be honest, I thought the set was sloppy.
Wow. Because it was loosey-goosey?
Much later. I didn't connect the dots, but much later the performance was released on CD, and somebody wrote the liner notes and did all the research and found out they were actually, somebody dosed them. It was DMT, I think.
Oh so, my God. So
they were like not quite there, you know, or they were on the fourth stone from the sun.
So it
explains why the performance was uneven. And if you listen to the CD, I mean, if you're there and you're seeing this, the visual, it just kind of fills in some of the blanks, and you kind of, you know, you're not paying as close attention to was that a clam, or did he actually hit the right note, or, you know, the other thing was that this was early in the period when Colombian weed was making its way into southern Florida, and so my buddy Charlie and I partook of the herb before we got there, and it was quite powerful, and we were probably five on the fifth stone from the sun maybe at the time. So, you know, all things considered. So that was the first one. Now he was there. This was a 2-day event, and they were supposed to play 2 days. And the first day was kind of foggy and kind of dodgy or overcast rather. And I remember it rained a little bit at some point, but anyway, the Sunday show got rained out. And Hendrix was staying at the Castaways, which is just south on A1A, just a little bit. He and his band were staying at this hotel called the Castaways, 163rd Street and Collins Avenue. And that's where Rainy Day Dream Away was written.
Wow.
In the wake of, because they couldn't go play this gig and it was raining. And okay, that's so Rainy Day Dream Away. Okay. This is all, this is all part of Hendrix history, and people can look this up and verify if they like, but that's all true. The second time I saw him was in the summer of 1970. No, excuse me. Was in the summer of 68. at Devonshire Downs. Now, meanwhile, this was, I'd seen him in Florida at Gulfstream, at the Miami Pop Festival in May 68. Family moves to LA in June. July was the Devonshire Downs Festival in the West Valley. And Hendrix was one of the headliners who played there.
Wow.
I saw part of that set. I didn't have tickets. I was in the process of sneaking in when he was playing his set. So I didn't catch the whole part of it. But
what was your impression of that set?
I didn't think it was very good.
Wow.
You know, from what the parts that I caught, it was kind of sloppy.
And then,
you know, we found out there were a lot of rumors going around that he'd been arrested for heroin in Canada just before that. And he might not even be there because they might still have him arrested. And, you know, then he shows up and it was really a crazy time, I'll tell you. And anyway, but there were problems with technical problems or some other issues. And
that's so very common, man.
He didn't turn in a good set there. And he felt, again, I'm finding out this later by reading it, but at the time I had no idea. He felt bad about it and then came back the next day and jammed with some of the other musicians, but I didn't make it, you know, the second day. So I didn't see that. The time though, that was the best was the San Diego Sports Arena in, I believe it was July of 1970. It's like literally 6 weeks, 2 months before he died.
Wow.
Billy Cox was on bass. Noel Redding was gone by that time. And I was, some friends of mine from Florida were out visiting. They were staying in Ocean Beach, which is just, you know, one of the beach communities in San Diego. And I was hitchhiking down from LA to hang out with them. And we're driving on the interstate on the way down. And we drive by the San Diego Sports Arena. And the marquee says, Jimi Hendrix, tonight, 350, 450, and 550.
What?
And I basically shit a brick, and I got to my friend's house and I said, did you know that the, and they said, no. I said, so, you know, we immediately all went to the sports arena. Now I had, okay, full disclosure, I had made a stop on the way down in Laguna Beach and picked up some little orange barrels. So when I got to San Diego and hooked up with the guys and we all went to the sports arena box office, this was still in the late afternoon because, you know, we went immediately to buy tickets because we thought it would be sold out if we didn't. And it was only, you know, a mile and a half away from where they were staying. They had rented some, you know, beach dump from somebody. So we dropped our barrels and went to see the show. And it was pretty amazing because the hall was set up where the band was in the middle of an oval arena.
That's cool.
But the band was facing one side of the arena and the other side was completely curtained off. Like they had not sold the whole arena.
Wow.
And they put the people who were there in half of the arena. And there were still empty seats to the extent that, like, our seats were kind of up toward the back, right, when the show started. And then we see all these empty seats down, and we're starting to come on, you know, and it's fucking Hendrix. And he's just, he's on fire, man. We just pooshed down to the stage. So I'm standing there with my mouth open for like an hour and a half, just mind blown.
Wow.
Just,
do you remember what songs he played?
Pretty much the repertoire. I remember in particular, Stone Free was crazy. Wow. There was an extended version of that. Some of these tunes are on Hendrix in the West.
Right. Okay.
I remember his Voodoo Child Slight Return was, oh my God.
That's so great. Did you hear Wind Cries Mary or Fire or Hey Joe or any of those?
Fire, Hey Joe. It was, he played a lot of the,
Panic Depression. Did you hear any of that?
No. He was playing some later stuff. Room Full of Mirrors. Wow. I remember he played that.
He probably did As Cold as Love, maybe?
He didn't do Axis.
Okay.
I mean, Axis is my favorite of his three major albums.
Great, too.
And you know, yeah, you got me floating and, you know, Axis, but he didn't do a lot of that. And I was kind of disappointed in that. But what he did do, we could look up the set list. It's got to be there. But what was crazy was that coming out of it, we were peaking. At the end of the show, so you walk out of the show and thousands of people milling around, going to the parking lot. It was like chaos. And can you imagine being
that's so crazy
psychedelicized at that particular moment? And I didn't know where we were or where I was. I just knew the name of the street that these guys were staying at. So I managed to make it out to where all the cars in the streets were. And there were kids, they're all people our age. And I just asked the first car that I said, "Hey, do you know where this street is?" "Yeah, we're going right by. Hop in."
"What?"
They dropped me off. "Is this your house?" "No, no, that doesn't look like it." "Oh, that's it. There it is. There it is."
That's so funny.
And I was the first one home.
That's so wild.
All the other guys were like just completely out of their minds and hadn't navigated home yet. And then one by one, they just kind of, they walk in just going, "Oh my God, what did we do?"
Do you remember Jimi Hendrix's guitar tone? It must have been just a screaming tone.
Well, it wasn't just necessarily screaming. I thought, you know, in our cosmic haze that he was speaking with it.
Right. Right. Yes.
The voicings. And I think, you know, even without benefit of psychedelic drugs, his voicings, particularly on not necessarily the loud ass stuff, but some of the more quiet, contemplative things. Wind Cries Mary would be a perfect example. Just the nuances and the fine touches and the subtle nature of it, you know, the beauty of it is as beautiful as the power of the balls out stuff.
Yeah. Well, I covered a lot of Hendrix stuff on this new record. I
can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. I covered Manic Depression, Wind Cries Mary, Fire. What else did I do? I did a little blurb of Third Stone from the Sun.
Nice.
And just, I mean, it was like really kind of like a rite of passage to be able to learn those tunes and kind of play them and kind of make kind of want to modernize them too on like a fidelity level. But I mean, it was just such a pleasure to play these songs because they're still such great epic arrangements and songs and performances. I learned a lot of his licks. Red House, I'm like the most proud of like doing that song on the record. And I'm like super stoked for you to hear it. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, all these experiences that you had propelled you into wanting to be in broadcasting, propelled you to want to work at labels. You did a special interview with Les Paul. I'm dying to know about this because he's also one of my favorite musicians and people. I met him in New York. He signed my Les Paul studio. So he's one of my favorite musicians just for the fact that he was such a jazz presence and an innovative presence for multi-track recording. You know what I mean? He's the man.
Absolutely. Well, the short version is that I went to visit I used to work at Capitol Records from 77 to 80. And I stayed in touch with various people over the years there. And in the early 90s, they had a catalog division that was pretty robust. They had finally figured out that they had you know, in the vault there, they had this massive catalog that they could actually monetize. So they had created a catalog department to do just that. And one of the projects that was the guy who was in charge was a gentleman named Wayne Watkins. And I went to visit somebody else that I knew there, and they introduced me. And I'm sorry, I can't even remember now who that other person was. That's terrible.
That's all right.
But they introduced me to Wayne, and you know, our new catalog development guy. And so he invited me to come into his office. We sat down for a couple minutes, and I said, "So what are you working on?" And he told me this, that, and the other thing. And he says, "And I'm having a really hard time finding a writer to write the booklet to go along with this Les Paul box set that we're working on." And I said,
"Yeah, me. I look no further."
And, you know, I just went off for a couple of minutes about what I knew about him and what I thought about him and, you know, what I thought his role was, this, that, and the other thing. He says, okay. So long story short, Wayne put me in touch with Les through his assistant, Arlene, and his son, Russ Paul Jr. And this would be May 1991. And so I went to Mahwah, New Jersey. went to see him, and went to visit him at the same house that he and Mary produced all those great radio shows in, and that he produced so many of the great records in.
Right.
And we did an interview in pretty much the same room. I was sitting where Mary would sit when she would cut her vocals.
That's so
funny. The interview, we started about midnight. It ended about 7 a.m. And he cooked me SpaghettiOs for breakfast.
That's awesome, dude. What?
And you know, after that, he gave me a tour of the house, and pretty much every room was, you have to remember, the house was brand new in the late 40s, early 50s. It was a very Frank Lloyd Wright-esque kind of modern, I don't know the correct architectural terms, but, you know, there was a lot of nice stone and cantilever kind of, a lot of trees and very nicely landscaped lot and so forth. Just a beautiful place. But it was a little run down by this time. His right. touring Cadillac was sitting in the driveway, flat tires, pretty much dead. A lot of the rooms were...
This is the early 80s?
This was 1991.
Okay.
Yeah, let me double check here. Yeah, 1991.
He must have been in his 80s, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And he was still playing at Fat Tuesdays. Had not made the transition. This is before he had a major heart attack, had to stop for a while, then came back and was playing at the Iridium for the last couple of years.
I met him at the Iridium, and I just happened to have my guitar with me, and he signed it, and it was just an amazing show. I got to watch him play, too. It's amazing.
Well, looking back on it, it's really hilarious because of where I was sitting with him in this space where he would be miking up, you know, Mary, and I'm miking him up
right.
with my little dipshit Radio Shack mic, right? It's connected to my dipshit cassette player. Right. I wish I had a Nakamichi and I had used his mics. I don't know, you know, just never occurred. You know, let's go into your studio, Les, and roll tape in your, I don't know, man. It's just one of those things that in hindsight you go, why the?
Right.
But he was very gracious. It was great. He gave me basically front to back interview, and we were covering the Capitol years because the box set
Yeah.
Box set.
I know that box set very well.
It was about the Capitol years, which ended in 57. And then he signed with Columbia after that. And then in the early 60s, he and Mary split up. And that was basically pretty much the end of the heyday. But the focus of the interview was on birth to 58 and a ton of great stories. And I forget the number of tracks on the...
You talk about recording with Chet Atkins?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Chester and Lester sessions.
Yeah.
There's a section about that in the book. I think there are a couple of cuts, Chester and Lester cuts on the...
What do you say about like recording with Chet Atkins and just like working out those song arrangements?
Well, they didn't really work up the song arrangements.
Wow.
It was... Those two guys, by the time they sat down together, they'd known each other for years. And aside from that, they knew the Great American Songbook inside and out.
Right.
They could play it backwards, upside down, and you know, at 16 RPM or 33 RPM or 40, whatever, right?
Right.
So from what Les told me, they basically, let's just do these songs. And then they just sat down and played them. Wow. And the tape was rolling. Okay, what else do you want to do?
That's wild. And was Cappy being on a label, or was he just kind of like, it was an opportunity and it was just kind of like a way to get his music out? Like, what do you say about that experience of working at Capitol and recording and making records there?
Well, It really all started with Lover and his multi-tracking, on acetate that he presented to the Capitol Records folks in the late 40s. And they said, "Hamina, Hamina, Hamina, this is the new sound. We got to have more of this." And so that was it. He was just off and running, but he had learned, taught himself the art of multi-tracking,
We owe multi-track recording to him. I mean, he's the reason.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the creator, you know?
You know, both on tape and on disc.
Yep.
You know, and it's all in the booklet that accompanies the box set. But he tells the story about how Bing Crosby gave him a reel-to-reel recorder that had been captured from the Germans, and it was one of the first early reel-to-reel recorders. And Les managed to get two of them, and he jiggered with the heads of one of them and turned one of them into. So this is how he was able to develop multi-tracking on tape, a little bit, you know, kind of concurrent. I'm going to screw up my chronology here, so forgive me. But it was either before or after he developed the disc-to-disc overdubbing capability.
What was like the major thing that you kind of got from Les? Like, what was the coolest thing he said or best part of the interview? We're running out of time, so I just want to see if we can get like what's the pearl of wisdom that he gave you.
I think the greatest pearl of wisdom that he gave me is that it comes with a dinner. There would be, it's just, there are things that are part of life that you don't have any control about. You don't have any control over necessarily. You can control yourself, but there are forces in the universe that, I'm sorry, whether you're spiritual or not, if it's science or religion, either way, there's stuff going on that we don't know about.
Right.
And when something happens, it's not perfect. You know, there's some adversity that comes with it. It's just part of life. It comes with the dinner.
Right.
And when he told me that, I just had to sit back and reflect on that a minute, because it really is about how we handle the stuff that gets thrown at us.
Right.
Because it's going to get thrown at us. That's just the way it is. It comes with the dinner. How we handle it, how we do this, how we deflect, you know, we either deflect or absorb.
Right.
Okay. And if we absorb too much and it can be toxic, right? So you learn what to deflect and what to absorb over a lifetime, and then you die. Isn't that convenient?
How you respond to things and how you kind of like learn tools to kind of like respond to those things, you know, whether it's music or writing or making art or something. And he was one of those people that just innovated and overcame and, you know, was still doing it up until his 90s. You know, he was still playing. You know, so, Stephen, we're running out of time, but you know what? You've had such a storied career. I knew we were going to talk about Hendrix. I didn't know we were going to talk about Cream. I love that we got to talk about Les Paul. You've been in broadcasting. You've had your own TV show. You've been writing liner notes. You've had you did a whole thing on the Monterey Pop Festival. What do you feel right now, to sum this whole thing up? Do you think, where do you think the music industry is headed, or where do you think kind of music is headed as far as creators?
Nikki, I have no idea.
Me neither.
I'm not going to speculate, but I don't want this hour to get, or this time to get passed before I say it's an honor to be with you.
Likewise.
When you came to appear on my program at SCV TV, House Blend was the name of the show.
I remember.
And you walked in with your acoustic guitar, and we were ready to spend, you know, 2 hours on the session. And you nailed your four songs in one take each. Right. And we all just sat around and, okay, well, let's have a long lunch or something. The crew didn't know what to do with themselves. Never happened before. Didn't happen after that in 69 tapings that I did.
So I'm honored. I got chills, man. Thank you.
And your audience should know that's how you roll.
Well, I appreciate that. And you know what I've done? I'll tell you this. I've done a lot of interviews with a lot of people. And your interview is still, if not my favorite, one of my all-time favorites, because you knew the material. You asked really pertinent questions. You knew how to cultivate an interview. That's why I wanted to have you on the show, too, because you have so much like knowledge of music and experience and just wisdom. And you put it into everything that you do. I hope you always are putting it into something, because you're always cultivating and you're always got your finger on the point of culture, and never stop being that open-minded and pushing for artists to be heard and, you know, for stories to be told, because that's what it's about. I'm excited for you to listen to this record. It's getting mastered as we speak, and it's 98.9% done. And we're just seeing if there's something else that we can add a little changes to, but I'm going to send you the record and we're going to do this again. And this time you're going to interview me, but thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have you back, man. You got way too many good stories.
Well, anytime.
Well, on behalf of Sam, myself, and Steven, we'll see you guys next week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And we'll see you guys next week. Peace and love.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.